Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Guys, it's episode 28. It is our season finale. It is our recap of that Red Saturday tournament you guys went to, which was great, good, moderate.
Amazing.
Super fab-tabulous.
Fab-tabulous.
Yeah. I think when you're rating it from one to the mountain, it's just below the mountain.
Is anything ever really the mountain, though?
Only the mountain could be the mountain, Sean.
So there's really, of all the news since our last, since the Stalic episode, basically the biggest news is that Chapter Pack 4 is out. Valor has hit the meta, and we're beginning to see the effects of that through the annals. And otherwise, lots of little Trident tournaments, non-US locations primarily. We still don't know the results of the Trident, but we will by the
it's
time.
It's looking like Maesters from what people are posting.
I don't know. There was a lot of armies in the States, and there seemed to be a lot of Maesters in Europe. So, as usual, Europe is saving us from evil Americans. No rebuttal.
You could see from the Twitter, there was more.
The Twitter participation was actually really low. So it was about, 200 people total. I mean, I know that from just the tournaments that have been posted, we have considerably more than 200 people invested in the outcome. I think it's just that Twitter is not a particularly great way to reach out to Thrones players.
I was going to say, what's the cross-section of card game nerds and Twitter? I don't think it's very high.
Well, it must be somewhat, but I'm enough of a card game nerd that I signed up for Twitter just to do these votes and will never use it again. Well, at least that's what I tell myself.
That's because you're not a 14-year-old girl.
to my
Sean's
knowledge,
new girlfriend's using it.
She gets younger by 2 years every time you mention her.
She's 20 and now she's 8.
At least it's always even numbers. Other important news of the last little while is that regional applications are out. So, in fact, you don't have much longer. I believe by the time this airs, you'll have a day to pester your store to apply for a regional. But there was some news in the regional announcement that I thought kind of interesting, that for basically all of the games in these regional kits, some locations will be able to apply to host a special two-day event that will include an alternate format on the second day. How do you guys feel about that?
Why would they include an alternate format that has no value?
I believe the goal is to give it value. It will have its own prize support and other stuff, but it's only going to be given out to places that can support a two-day tournament, where the joust cut would be, or part of the joust cut would be the next day, and then presumably the alternate format for Thrones would be melee, but I don't know, it might be draft or whatever else is run for that. It would also get
unhappy. Pressed. That's how I would phrase my reaction to that.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I can guess why, but I do think the idea of regionals being two-day events is actually not a bad idea for the shops that can run it.
I think that's a great idea, but the thing is, I'm tired of FFG flip-flopping over and over again on their events and bad communication, and I would wish they would just stick with what they said.
Well, what did
melee
they say?
Is not a competitive format. There's only one competitive format. It's Joust.
They haven't
said only going to be prize support for
it's
one
only
day.
Through their actions that they've said that. Not their words.
They literally said that. to me. Out loud. So, it's I don't know. It's silly.
They gave it a card design to Stalic. I mean, that's important. I like that.
It's silly. They should be doing the same thing everywhere.
Yeah, that's salt in the wounds, mentioning the Stalic melee card.
Yep.
Also, I think it's probably going to be draft. That seems to be the preferred alternate format now.
Well, it sells more product, I suppose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what they were doing. If they were shifting from melee to draft, I'm less mad.
Well, they haven't said what the alternate formats are going to be, and I don't even know if they're going to be necessarily obliged or if it'll be store-specific. That's also, but it's four places that are willing to run a two-day regional.
Maybe it'll be Hand of the King.
Maybe it'll be Hand of the King.
I did like Hand of the King.
So in additional news, there's the All Men Are Fools article announcing the next cycle, which has got gave us a new agenda. It gave us a new keyword. It gave us Martell cards that look interesting. It talked about adding extra economy.
It had a picture of you on the front.
No, it didn't.
The dog. It was pretty awesome.
With the dog. I still can't figure out who that is.
I have no idea who that is.
Like, I scoured the books and the Song of Ice and Fire. I have no idea who that is. And I really... we probably won't even find out in the first chapter pack, the All Men Are Fools one. Because art on the chapter packs has nothing to do with which cards are in them.
I was thinking it was the merchant lady that Arya deals with.
The merchant lady that Arya deals with?
Yeah. Do you not remember the merchant lady? What's her name? I'm going to sound like a fool now.
In what place?
In Essos.
What merchant lady does she deal with?
There's a merchant lady. There's a rich merchant lady. It's either Arya or Dany who deals with a rich merchant lady. I think it's Arya, though.
That sounds generic enough. Anyway, about the contents of the article rather than the picture of me, apparently, on the chapter back.
I think originally you accused it was everyone that was my champ card, and it was me on the cover.
I did say that was you with hair. Yes, I did say that.
But obviously it's not me, because this fine figure of a man that you are, Alex, is much thinner and, yes, more hairy. Anyways, Alliance, new agenda. Let's talk about that.
All right,
That's the one that's getting a lot of buzz, right?
Yeah, it's getting a lot of buzz, yeah.
I mean, it opens up a lot more deck building, right? Having two banner agendas in addition to this agenda, which basically lets you have your main house and then two other banners, seems pretty cool. It opens up a lot of interesting deck building ideas.
Ocean though Rose you're, compulsory in your deck.
Yeah, though you have a 75-card deck, which, you know, it does have its drawbacks. But I think people will play around with this quite a bit. I think we're going to see a bunch of it when it first comes out. People will be trying all kinds of cool stuff. And we'll see a lot of Banner to Night's Watch control-y decks happening too.
So I'm willing. I'll probably eat my words. But I initially think this will be very good. And my reasoning is the 75-card deck limit matters, and it matters more if you have limited draw. And right now we're not running a ton of draw, and we're not fueling that draw, and draw is all loyal. So you can only fit it in with one faction. So you will always be diluting your draw by going this way.
Yeah, you're going to eat your words.
No,
There's so much draw in some of the factions right now.
I think the combo potential is big. I think that we don't necessarily have the level of synergy required to offset that drawback yet. I think there'll be lots of fun decks you can play, and I think sometimes you'll draw into all the right cards to make it either a hugely negative play experience or whatever it is you're looking for. I think at the competitive level, this will take a little bit longer to start shining.
That's fair to say. I think people will be running Tyrell for the tutor effects in the draw to try and get those three faction card combos going.
Mm-hmm. Other stuff, they seem to be trying to give us more options for economy so that we're not just playing the same three Rose Road, three Kings Road, three in faction reducers or Ocean Roads. And I appreciate that. I'm not entirely sure
more
on that
limited
card. No, I think more limited is the right direction. And this is slightly more investment, but slightly higher payoff, sort of like the Arbor is. And I like having choices in my economy base. It gives us more options without increasing the whole power level. I don't know. How easy is it to get four or more characters in your opponent's dead pile as Targ? Shouldn't be that hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know when that pays off, like turn three.
You don't want to put it on turn one because they don't have that.
It's not completely wasted on turn one, but the payoff is late game. So you got to be looking for a game that's going to last longer with that card.
Yeah.
So do we imagine that the other factions will have similar effects? Greyjoy, like number of cards in a discard pile, or if you're the first player.
Yeah, stuff like Martell, that. I'm sure it'll be very...
or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm hoping Greyjoy's isn't be first player, because I'm kind of sick of the Greyjoy be first player theme.
It can be if you've won initiative this phase, or this round. That's not the same thing.
Again, going for initiative, I'd rather have a different strategy going for Greyjoy. Let's get a second archetype for Greyjoy. That'd be cool.
I agree.
Well, they have unopposed.
Is one-dimensional.
Yeah. Going first and unopposed. Those are your kind of the combo, too.
I'm sort of torn in saying, you know, I don't really want to see Village become a thing, but then again, it's one of their mechanics and it should get support, so.
I want to see Pillage become a thing. I want to mill someone's deck. I want to mill someone's deck, and I want them to feel bad about it.
So how do you guys feel about the bestow keyword? which we see on Ricasso, and it's described as basically when a card with bestow
more gold
play, yeah. You put more gold, so you invest more heavily in the character, or I guess card. It doesn't say it has to be a character, and you get presumably a larger payoff based on what you've put in.
I think it's a neat mechanic, paying more into things. It rewards Lannister again, I think, who come naturally with more gold. But it's also very thematic, paying a mercenary. I could see a Bronn version that becomes stronger with pay. But I think there's potential there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, on one hand, it's interesting to me. At the same time, I don't like this idea where I can play these low cost curve characters, you know, especially at the four, things that aren't hit by first snow. And then I have the option in the late game to buff them, unless they're always not as good as their counterparts would be at that cost threshold. So if they're four, I want my four cost characters to be better than them. And in fact, if you pay six for them, I want the six cost characters to be better than them too in general.
Right.
And that you kind of lose some strength for the flexibility.
Yeah, I agree.
But so I mean, as long as they design that, I'm happier.
If you look at that Ricasso that we're seeing, and he is at the three cost slot, so he's vulnerable to first snow and things like that.
Yeah.
He is. He's 3-for-3 Bicon. That's underpowered. And he has the allied trait. That's underpowered. But he has an ability that means you can invest a little bit more in him.
Yes.
I don't know if that ability has, again, a high ceiling if you've got lots of cards that play off it, or it could just do nothing. It also seems like you won't be able to pay bestow costs on setup, which makes them weaker setup cards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not a bad idea. I think
they could be very careful with the balance.
In that other card game in Magic, isn't it? People informally call it like a kicker or something. You pay a little extra and you get a little more effect out of the card.
I might didn't be making play Magic that with kicker. I thought kickers return cards or something when you paid extra.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm probably butchering the terminology.
And you then, know who would know? Google.
Google would know, but then I'd have to type it in, and I'm
hoping. Oh, no, you don't have to do that. I understand how hard that is, so I'll do that for you.
I have a baby in my hands. And then the last sort of thing they touched on is this event that returns to your hand if you pay gold. So another, I think they're really pitching generating more economy and giving you more ways to use it flexibly. And I think that card that they teased us, this Prince's Plan card, is actually really, really good as a recurring event.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to see Prince's Plan with the Long Plan and just sort of, or even Littlefinger's Meddling.
So you're right, Alex. Kicker is exactly bestow. Good one, FFG. You stole it from Magic.
Okay.
They even have multi-bestow.
Good one. Alex actually got something right for once.
They even have multi-bestow or multi-kicker in Magic.
Oh, I knew that mechanic was suspiciously good. It had to come from Magic.
It had to come from Magic.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. We're doing a very special episode today, aren't we, Sean?
We are. This is pretty close to us because we were both recently involved in an aforementioned event-centric, the thing that this episode's focused on.
Yeah, you're talking about Red Saturday, but I was actually kind of mentioning the fact that Alex isn't here so we can run wild, and I'm actually recording in the nude just like you are, so that makes things special.
Yeah, this is Beyond the Wall at night, or after dark.
After dark. Oh, well, I like
first,
it.
It's after first, dark. We have to have a disclaimer. If you're not 18 plus, please make sure your parents can't see you listening to this.
Yeah, you want to make sure your parents don't know you're listening. Very important. But
this
we're joined
got
by
strange Kat. Really, really fast.
Oh, that's right. This is a threesome.
And stranger.
We're actually joined by Dave. He took second at Red Saturday.
Hello, everybody.
He doesn't really want to be here, but because he's our friend, he has to be. It's kind of awkward for him.
It's contractual.
Yeah.
Some of that is true. Thank you for having me on. I'm actually very happy to be here. I have not been on an episode in, I don't know, a year maybe, right?
Yeah.
Well, probably since last Red Saturday, actually.
But you did really well at Red Saturday this year. You took second.
I did. That was fun. I hadn't played in a long time, and it's nice to know that something has come back pretty quickly.
And it's not riding a bike.
Not only did you take second, you took second with a deck that was a little bit innovative. So I think I want to start off with that. Can you tell us about the deck you decided to take?
I can. So did that end up being true that this was innovated? Because I wasn't entirely sure when I built it. There were no real brand new cards except for Valor that were legal in the environment. But I was hearing buzz from people who were watching me that it was playing differently than I guess a lot of normal decks.
Yeah, I mean, you had that experience when we met up the day before the event and we played a few games and I said, oh, there was this Shalik list. And you said, well, I didn't see that list. And I said, there's this other list. And you said, I didn't see that list. And you said, I haven't played in 5 months, but this is what I think is fun, so I'm going to play it. And there was a bunch of cards in there that were, you know, they're not new cards, but they're underplay cards. They're things that people would be surprised about. And I think that was the whole point of you playing them, right? Because they were surprising.
Well, they were fun. So, I mean, I was playing a deck that wanted to basically ambush as much as it could. I didn't want to play characters in marshalling. I wanted to get guys in during the challenge phase, and I wanted to get characters in and play events that were going to have an impact on the board state in terms of character control and character removal. For people who played first edition, I wanted it to play as much like kind of a Knights of the Hollow Hill Targaryen Jumpers deck as I could make it, because that was my jam for a couple of years of first edition. So I basically, you know, I was forced into Lannister because that's where the ambush is. This deck actually started as a Targ Banner Lion deck with a Harrenhal module, and then became a Martell Banner Lion deck with a Harrenhal module. I tried to use Hota and Arianne, and eventually I was kind of talking this through with Dan, and I said, you know, what I really need is an ambush event like Ambush from the Plains from first edition or Storm the Gate. And he said, well, that's what Hear Me Roar does. I had forgotten that card. I didn't know what it did. I read it. It ambushes in a character. It was Lannister only. So sadly, I took out the Lion House card. And after that, I just put in all the ambush guys, including those ones that cost 4 with the intrigue icons. Those guys are fun surprises. The Harrenhal, and I kind of started tweaking from there.
Well, I remember when you came over the first day that we were just goofing off, drinking beer, and playing some games, and I told you about Tower of the Hand. Why didn't you tell me about this card? This is a good card.
I remain angry at Dan for not mentioning that it existed. He said he didn't remember either. Yeah, I mean, the deck at that point was trying to get guys onto the board, and then, in theory, get them off of the board, like the Hound did it by himself, but what I felt like I really did need was another card that just got a guy off the board. And the Tower of the Hand not only does that, but also bounces one of the opponent's guys. I probably should have run 3 of that at the end of the day. I ended up running 2. That's a really good card.
Oh, yeah, especially with your deck. And you want to bounce your Intrigue Chuds and then replay them and just apply as much pressure to the board.
Not even necessarily Chuds. I mean, I was doing that with Cersei. I was bouncing cost 5 and 6 guys. You jump her in with Harrenhal. You bounce her back with Harrenhal.
Yeah, and duck the kill.
Even better if you do it with Jaime, because then you get to do the military challenge first, then the intrigue, then you bounce him, and you bounce one of their 5 or 4 strength guys. It's a strong location. It is not surprising to me that location was nightmaresed and newly made lorded more than anything else throughout the course of my tournament day. But the way the deck was trying to work, so it was a Reigns of Castamere deck, Alvaro's new agenda, and it would typically open with trading with the Pentoshi, not only to give me a bunch of gold to work with, which I wanted to use during the challenges phase, maybe to drop a big character in marshalling, but also to give my opponent gold and encourage my opponent really to overextend, to play out their hand. So then once I got into challenges, I could really do one of two things. I could use the agenda to cycle into the Warden's scheme plot, Wardens of the West, and then hopefully take them down from, you know, 4 cards to 1, from 5 cards to 2, maybe even clear their hand entirely. If their hand's empty, I can Valor on round 2, and then they pretty much lose. If they've got a lot of dupes out, or they don't kill their hand that hard, or for some reason I think Valor is going to be bad, I can go to Wildfire instead and get them down to 3 characters. And the nice thing at that point is there's a lot of redundancy in this deck. There were 11 cards that would let me get an extra character off the board after that wildfire. Three of the Red Keep Spy, three of the Queen's Assassin, three of the Trial by Combat, and two of the Tower of the Hand. So it's a pretty good bet that I've got one of those 11 to start the game. I can flip into wildfire, you're down to three characters. I can kill or bounce one more, you're down to two. I do mill, you're down to one, and then I can march your last guy. But one way or another, I'm looking to have you with an empty board at the beginning of round two.
And how often did that actually pan out in reality? You played how many games? 9 games that day? 10 games?
6 and 3. I played 9 games. When I opened with that plan, and sometimes I deviated to open with either Famine or First Snow if the board called for it. I think I did that twice out of the 9. So of the other 7, it probably worked 5 times that I either cleared the board by round 2 or had the option to march on round 2. Sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I would Famine on round 2 instead of march. I didn't want to blow the march. It wasn't a guy that was worth marching, but I could apply the pressure just as easily by playing Famine. Where it worked pretty well. I think there was only one game maybe where I was not able to trigger Reigns on the first turn, yet I wanted to.
Was that the final?
No, the final ended up being weird. In the final, his three characters after Wildfire, I think it was Tywin, the double intrigue claim Cersei, and Sir Illyn. And I think that the removal card that I had in my hand was the Spy. You can only bounce a cost 3 character. I had a duped Cersei and a Tywin, and I knew I was kind of in a bad spot. I ended up Valoring on round 2, hoping he wouldn't march, and he did march. So we both ended up with an empty board round 2, 1 power, and the game ground slowly from there. We had a similar sized hand.
Brutal. So you think at that point it was just top decking that let one person win, or did he just outplay you because you haven't played in a while, or what led to your loss?
It was some of both of that. I mean, let me say first, Tom is an excellent player. When I sat down, I saw that the playmat he was playing on was a Star Wars World Champion mat. And at that point, I was fairly confident that he was a better player than I was. I played Star Wars for a while. It's a hyper-technical, very, very tactical game. You cannot be good at that game if you make even small play mistakes. If he's a world champion, I'm assuming he makes no play mistakes. I didn't see him make play mistakes. I was trying to outmaneuver him in terms of strategy. But that too was difficult. He's a very, very good player, very smart guy. And there was one point in the game where I felt like the game kind of hinged on, he did an intrigue challenge. I had 2 cards in hand. One was the Hound and one was something terrible. And if I had kept the Hound at that point, I think I might have been able to keep enough pressure up, potentially to swing the game back. But the intrigue claim went wrong. He got the Hound and didn't see good characters after that.
Yeah, he is a very good player. I mean, I played a one-sided game where he basically put me over the table with his unicorn horn. It was kind of horrible. But I could tell, even from that experience, which wasn't very pleasant, that he was a very good player.
Yeah.
So
all the congrats to him. He obviously had a great day, and he played a very, very solid game against me.
What were your highlights other than playing against him for the tournament? Was there some game or particular event that you thought was just amazing? I mean, shout-outs to New York for holding a great event with crazy prize support, and Roy and Dan and yourself for organizing it.
It was a lot of fun. I'm just always glad that it was so well attended and well received. Highlights, certainly in terms of it, if there was a card in my deck that sort of overperformed, I guess it was probably Nightmares. Against your advice, John, I cut all my treacheries for Nightmares because I didn't want to give up more than 3 slots to that kind of effect. At the end of the day, that may have been a mistake, I will say, because as I was doing the calculus, I was saying, well, I can Nightmares Caitlyn, I can't Treachery Caitlyn, I can do both to Winterfell. Seems like they're kind of doing similar things. What I didn't account for was Newly Made Lord, which did in several games blow up my Tower of the Hand and ruin some of my carefully laid plans. That's a place where Treachery would have shined. So I would, by way of, you know, segue, work 2 treacheries back into the deck, but I would not cut any Nightmares. I had a great day Nightmaresing the Arbor and marshalling, King's Roads and marshalling, you know, things beside Caitlyn and Winterfell, which I did also to some good success. But just that extra choke, especially on a Famine turn, they're sitting there, they think they're okay, they're going to get 3 gold from the Arbor, they make me first, and then all of a sudden they get no gold from the Arbor that they spent 4 gold on. That's a huge tempo swing. So I think Nightmares probably overperformed a little bit and was a bit of a standout in terms of a single event or a single card.
I'm curious to know about your Reigns deck in particular, because you have 5 cards here. You're running the Kneel, the Stand, Wildfire, Wardens, Riddle. Is there any one of those you'd switch out, or did you get good use out of Riddle? Because I know that could be a tricky one. Sometimes.
I got good use out of Riddle. We started on Friday by me telling John that was a bad card and to cut it from his deck. He convinced me to put it into mine, and I'm convinced that was a good choice, although I maintain that it's not that it's a bad card, but I think it's a gamble in a non-Reigns deck. Obviously, there are times when you can call your opponent's plot, but it may never come to pass that the perfect time comes to play it. In a Reigns deck, obviously their plot is face up. I drew cards on that all day with Counting Coppers. I knocked off negative attachments on my guys with my opponent's confiscations. I summoned for things. I building seasoned for things. I think I used a March to the Wall once. I triggered that plot probably more than any other except for Wildfire, because I think I hit that one in almost every game, because at some point there was going to be something big that was face up that was going to get me something I needed. I cut Littlefinger's meddling for it, which I did not miss. I don't think I ever found myself in a situation where I said, man, if I just had the gold to pay this event, I could do something epic. I typically had the gold when I needed it, or I could make the gold when I needed it.
Cool. I can see you're also running Moon Brothers with the Reigns agenda. And I know we were playtesting that before, and we were trying to map out how many faction Neil effects you had. So right now on the deck, you only have the four with, you know, Reigns and the three brothers.
Right.
Did you find they came in conflict with each other, or were you able to play around it?
No. So it's really important to trigger Reigns on the first turn. You want to either hit their board or hit their hand hard so that you can have an aggressive second turn and establish board control at that point. After the first turn, there's rarely a time when you have to trigger Reigns. It's often nice. You know, it's great to kneel a guy. You can stand a guy. Maybe you want to Riddle and do something, copy one of their plot effects. But after you've gotten their board under control, you need to keep the control on the board. And Moon Brothers is a card that lets you surprise win either really any challenge, as long as you have a clansman in it. So, you know, Chella has the intrigue icon and Timid has the power icon. But it lets you surprise push that challenge that they thought they were going to be able to block, and then potentially do another challenge with the Moon Brothers, the military, if you haven't done that yet, or if you have the location, the Mountains of the Moon in play, you just give them another icon when they jump in. So the cost of kneeling the faction card after the first turn, it's much less important that you trigger Reigns and much more important that you push those challenges. And that's really what Moon Brothers allows you to do. It's another surprise, another trick the deck has, and a deck full of tricks, really.
So do you think you hit the right number of clansmen with Mountains?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's 11, because it was three Burnmen, three Moon Brothers, two Chella, two Timit, and one Shaga. So that seemed fine. I don't think I ever found myself in a situation where I had the Moon Brothers and nothing and no clansmen I could interact with. And, you know, if Mountains of the Moon sat there for a couple turns unused from time to time, that's not the end of the world. It was a one-cost location.
Another really important difference from your deck and a lot of Jumper Lannister decks right now is that you're running the original Tyrion as opposed to the new clansman Tyrion. How did you find that panned out? Do you think you would have done better, or?
Well, so John alluded to the fact that, you know, when you guys showed up at Dan's house, he looked at my deck and said, oh, it's similar to the Shalik deck. He convinced me to take that one for a spin. I started off adamant that I wouldn't play it. I saw him or you or Matt play it. I said, okay, this does look strong. So I changed, I think it was 19 cards. And I played a couple of games with the other version. It's an incredibly strong deck, probably stronger than my deck. I think I said that in my Card Game DB. Not Card Game DB, a Thrones DB write-up. Just from a Jamie perspective, you know, that can be an impressive deck. I felt like two things. One, I felt like it was less fun because this runs into two. I think it was less surprising. Most of the tricks in that deck and the power in that deck ended up being pretty visible on the board, whereas in the version I built, most of the tricks ended up being secrets from my hand. Perhaps predictable ones at time, but nonetheless, knowledge that you don't get from just looking at the board. So that's really what I valued in this deck, was having the flexibility and the surprise factor to adapt to whatever my opponent was going to throw at me, rather than putting the cards down and trusting that I had enough power from that position to push through. In terms of Tyrion in particular, this Tyrion fuels the gold. There's a lot of expense in this deck that is not in the other version. The Queen's Assassin and the Red Keep Spy both cost 4 gold each. the other deck, the Shalik version, was not running Trial by Combat. That's a 2-gold event. So for all those reasons, you need some more gold. And the Quartyrian costing 2 less to begin with and then generating more once he's down was a big help.
Yep. And it also helps you push through on like a Stark board with Catelyn. You can
see. Oh, yeah. He's got the stealth. I mean, unfortunately, he can't trigger Reigns by himself. Mm-hmm. But as long as he can stealth Catelyn or with Widow's Wail.
Did you end up playing any Stark on the day?
I did. I played at least one that beat me. I don't remember if I played another one that I beat. The game against Chris Vack was the last round of Swiss. He was another very good player who really didn't make any play mistakes. He had the double milk on my Tyrion. I said to John, I don't want to run Confiscation because after I knock off a milk with Confiscation, we'll just play another milk. And John says, yeah, because they always have 2 milks. Well, John, they always have 2 milks.
They don't always have 2 milks. You are just the most unlucky man in the world.
Worse than that in that game, because I probably could have survived the 2 milks, and I probably could have survived the ward on my Pycelle the first round, which sucks. I didn't draw a single economy card. No fiefdoms, no Rose Roads, no King's Roads. Without a little bit of help on the economy fronts, that game never really got off the ground.
Yeah, I was playing a Stark Fealty, as was John, and I think my entire day, as opposed to John, who I don't think played much Reigns, I played Reigns all day long. And it was all Reigns with Valor.
Yep.
And there was only one opponent who I remember getting their Reigns trigger off because of Catelyn or Winterfell or both.
Yeah.
That's a really messy deck to play against.
Well, we played that match between playing against some of you guys and playing against Dan the night before. I probably played that match about 8 times. And it seemed like it was just kind of a very long, very grindy 50-50. That you'd both end up in really bad shape on plot like 8 or 9, and then it comes down to who top decks their answer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was my feeling as well.
We had some grinding matches that went to like an hour 20.
And it didn't turn on skill, right? Like we'd both play well, mm-hmm. and then it would just like someone would top deck the right answer when we were out of cards and broken.
Essentially, on the day of, I was hoping I wouldn't play you. That was my one hope.
Well, you got your wish.
Maybe in the cut, that would have been nice, but oh well.
Well, Sean did do a championship thing. He lost the best way possible.
Man, how's that? I missed this.
Cards and deck.
Ah, that's the worst.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention this. Thank you again, Alex Hines, for defending the tie rules. It's now my third time in a major tournament where I've lost and been denied the cut because of a draw deck.
Once the game was going on and the perfect tie happened, and it was obvious that Sean, if he could win initiative, like whoever won initiative next round was going to win the game, probably. Luckily, he's playing some high initiative plots, but when we find out it's an actual tie, I start chanting cards in deck. Like 3 or 4 other people joined.
Here's the worst part. My opponent miscounted, and he said he had 29 cards left, and I had 31. So I thought I won. So he counts it again. He comes back to 29. The rule is the
judge has to count.
So Roy came over and he recounted them and he discovers, oh, wait, it's 33 or 32 or whatever it was.
It's a bad miscount. That's not off by one.
Speaking about awesome things that happen like this, did you guys hear what happened to the Brotherhood?
What happened to the Brotherhood?
So my very first match, I sit down and I start playing. And a few seconds in, a judge is called to my left. And I look over and it's one of the fine Brotherhood. I won't mention who, so that way he won't feel embarrassed. But it's one of the guys from the Brotherhood, not the world champion. And
we'll call him Teeth.
Yeah, we'll call him Teeth. That's right. Teeth. And I hear that his opponent shuffled his complete hand
through
his deck on round one.
I think he did like a summons or something.
And so I don't know how it happened. I just know he shuffled his whole hand into his deck, so he has no hand now.
When I heard this story, I thought this was a card effect, like take them by surprise or something from first edition that I didn't know about. I was like, what card does that?
So his whole hand is in his deck, and he's like, damn, do I lose the game? And I said, I don't think so. Call the judge. So Roy comes over, and Roy's like, no, you don't lose the game, but you don't have a hand. Like, you can't recreate your hand. So basically, gives him a death sentence, right? Like, I'm sorry you shuffled in your hand, but we can't take your word on what was in your hand.
On what
like
was in your hands.
Yeah, there's no way. I think everyone agrees with that ruling. So he's got no hand, and he wins the game. Okay.
No, he won?
He won the game.
Wow.
So, and I talked to him afterwards. I was like, how was it? He's like, well, I had a slightly better setup. And then I drew well. And I'm like, the other guy had 12 cards on you or something. He had 9 cards in hand, and you had none.
That may be the greatest comeback in the history of card games.
It's awesome.
I'm looking forward to the next episode of the Brotherhood Without Manners to hear them all rail on poor Teeth, because it has to happen.
Oh, it has to. They can't do otherwise. He lost to a guy with no hand on round one. Okay, back on track. Sean, you played some cards too.
I did play some cards. I lost some cards as well. So I went 4-2. I was leading 3 undefeated. I played that match where I got the tie and I lost on the card, the deck, the cards left in deck. And my match going into the cut was determining whether I was going in or not. And it was a friend of the Brotherhood playing the Brotherhood deck. And I knew what deck it was and I knew what they were playing because we kind of know how they play. They're good players, but they want to play aggressive decks, right? So I didn't think there was going to be much beyond, you know, they've got saves from Greyjoy and they've got big beefy characters. It turns out that's what they're playing.
Right? Was this the Tyrell?
Yeah, this is the Tyrell Kraken.
I played that deck 3 times also.
Yeah, so they have like 12 saves in the deck with like the Arbor and Renly and Victarion, right? Just like big beat sticks and lots of saves. It's, you know, it's a winning strategy. It's how they have done so well in all the previous tournaments because they keep doing well. They keep showing up with big beat sticks. And it's hard to shut them down if they get rolling. So this is a friend of theirs who's playing, and he's an excellent player. I think he hadn't really played with the deck much before, they were saying, but on the day of, he really took a shining to it. At any rate, I made a critical mistake in one of the rounds. I killed Jory over a Last Hearth Scout, and I don't need the Last Hearth Scouts against a Tyrell Greyjoy deck. I think they might be running one Olenna Spy if they're running any at all. It was kind of a critical mistake. I had the Last Hearth Scouts out there for Claim Soak. But, I mean, I made the mistake, so that cost me the cut. So I can't blame anyone else but me.
Because you weren't able to use Jory to save versus their Valor later on and keep that key character with a bunch of power on it.
Yeah, I had Rob with something like 4 or 5 power on him. He was doing work.
Yeah.
And I was predicting his Valors too early. I was playing response cards to Valor. Like, okay, if I do this, I can recover better from it. Maybe get Summer on the board and pick some characters up. But he kept delaying his Valor because he was in an okay position. I had more power than him, and I was actually edging towards the victory condition. I think it was at like 12 at some point. But he had so many saves and so many strong characters in hand and on the board that he didn't need the Valor right away. So that was very well played by him and very poorly played by me. So he proceeded to the cut.
Yeah, I think my loss in the Swiss was due to a play mistake as well. I let someone get a range trigger off that I shouldn't. I had played the Stark plot that allows me to jump in characters into challenges, and he had Stealth Catelyn, and I had used one of my scouts to block and then was not smart enough to jump Catelyn in to prevent the range trigger, and he was able to wildfire and then kind of grind me out. I honestly feel that my loss in the cut, though I played a great player, was mostly due to the fact that I drew both my area's gifts, all 3 ice, and my 2 of my winters is coming. I just couldn't get some Chudley characters to get on the board for Claim Soak. So after that, I just couldn't get characters out.
Variants gotcha.
Yeah. Can we talk about how money Aria's Gift is?
Such a good card.
I used that a few times to shock my opponents, and every time they're like, could I read that card? Because it's not played all that often. Maybe not in North America. Maybe it's more of a European card. But being able to move ice onto a character who's from a character who's not in the challenge to a character who is, yep, for the pump and then the win and then the result. My favorite move, moving it off of Catelyn when it's a Reigns deck and they think they can get it off, and then Catelyn says no fun allowed. She just moves it right over onto a Tumblestone. He loses his flavor text, but it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
I'm not willing to make that sacrifice, not flavor text.
Also, my favorite move of the day is when I moved it from Catelyn to Sansa. So she no longer had the penalty from characters in the dead pile, and I had a fairly chunky dead pile, and I was playing a Reigns deck. So I'm like, thank you for the permanently strong Sansa, who's only going to get stronger when Septa Mordain shows up, because it's not blanking that. And now
Septa,
I get the block.
What a winner that is.
Yes.
Yeah, Septa's so good.
I remember in between one of my matches, there were some people talking in the corner, and I heard them saying, Septa Mordain is the MVP of the whole day.
Yeah, she is so good. She is amazing. 2 of was a great decision on our part. I would, you know, even consider 3 of in some decks. So good.
Just with testing, but yeah. No, she's
well, amazing. I mean, she does so much in a Valor meta where she's, you know, people are like, well, Ariane's going to already survive with her dupe. because she'll just use her dupe. I'm like, I'd rather not use her dupe. I'd rather have a duped character after Valor.
And military stealth and Valor.
Yeah. And being able to dupe Septa has good value, and that extra intrigue is good.
She also ends up not immune to just Valor, but First Snow.
Oh, I know.
I mean, I remember looking at boards in some of our practice games where it's like, oh, Valor. Oh, wait, it's not going to kill Arya or Bran. Oh, First Snow, not going to bounce Arya or Bran.
There's no point.
No point. None of this deck is built on reset plots, and none of them work right now.
Yeah, and I played a mirror match against another Stark player, and as we know, the mirror match is basically who draws more renown first. And Septa did huge work for me. Septa was probably the pivotal card in that match, and I remember at one point he building seasoned and got an attachment to steal Septa, and he stole Septa, and on my turn, I immediately stole Septa back, and then we had a little banter back and forth about whether he was going to confiscate to try to get Septa, or if I was going to confiscate to get his confiscate, but then I think I convinced him I didn't have confiscate in my deck, and we both ended up confiscating, and I kept Septa. I think that was the turning point with the a little bit of banter back and forth, and he goes, I didn't think you would lie to me, and I said, well, I didn't really lie to you, I just implied a lot, and you know I like Melee.
I love
he's like,
this.
I should have known better.
Nothing like a little bit of table talk to swing a game.
You spent two turns fighting over Septa Mordain. That tells you how great she is.
Yeah, and well, we both had Sansa, right? And that was the key renown that that let me win it in the end. So, and it also burned his confiscation, which let me milk his Ed and kind of hold him back.
Mm-hmm. Do you know my second favorite part of the day?
Oh, please tell us.
Aside from how fun the deck was. So we drove down with John, myself, and Matt from the Ottawa meta, formerly of the Thunder Bay meta, but we've absolved him. Absorbed, I should say. Absolved him of his Thunder Bay sins and absorbed him into the Ottawa meta. So I played both of the people who beat John and Matt early on in the day. I think it was like your third match and Matt's second match or something like that. I played them, and I beat them both immediately after they played John. And we're all playing the same deck. So I think that means officially that I'm a better player than Matt and John. I think that's
okay,
what it means.
Because you beat the one person that beat me, but I went 5-1 and you didn't make the cut does not make you a better player.
Whoa. I lost on a tie. I blame that. I put that at Alex Hines' feet.
Well, here's what we could do. We could play the game a dozen times and see who wins more matches.
Okay, but you have to play drunk.
I'm still going to win. you know that that's how I play best, right? It's like saying...
Okay. You have to play with duct tape on your mouth.
Oh, that's a disadvantage. Anyways, you know, some of the favorite stuff I had was actually hanging out at Dan Hall's house. And shout out to Dan for having us and bringing us to Thanksgiving and putting us up. And he really makes the trip possible for us. And, you know, I want to say a big thank you. But hanging out with Dave and Dan and just having fun with Thrones friends is the best part of the whole trip. And I think that's what Thrones is all about, is having it. You know, we all go out afterwards, and we went to the a local restaurant, and then some of those younger kids went out and sung karaoke and had a good time.
God, I felt so old.
Me too. I was done. But us older folks, you know, we went home at midnight. Or
at midnight. I mean, but it was respectable.
Yeah, it wasn't. You know, 4:30 in the morning when you stumbled in, Sean, and the fact that Matt woke up still drunk the next day couldn't help me drive.
Like the third trip where he's woken up drunk and been unable to drive.
So I soloed the 14 hours home with traffic. It was awesome.
We should give Matt some credit, though. He didn't fall asleep on the way back.
That was his first time. But Dave, while we were driving, I don't know if you know this, but I won an imaginary trophy this year.
Yeah,
it's overall. I guess there's two imaginary trophies, one for overall and one for the melee. And Sean and I have decided that we're actually going to be giving out card designs to all the imaginary trophy holders. So Ryan Jones, and there was a gentleman that won at Worlds as well, this imaginary trophy. And these card designs are going to be really important. So we designed that card. Would you like to hear about the card?
I would love to hear the card.
The card is he has zero strength. Bicon, who has military and power, but he has the melee keyword. Do you remember the melee keyword, Dave?
I do remember the melee keyword.
So for those listeners that don't know the melee keyword, do you want to describe it to them?
It creates a lot of messed up math. A character with the melee keyword when participating in a challenge gets +1 strength for every character on the other side of the same challenge. So a zero strength character with melee who was blocked by 3 characters would all of a sudden be 3 strength.
Yep. That's exactly it. And the other cool part of this character is that all power that's claimed, so whether it's from house card, renown, or whatever, on your side of the board during that challenge goes to them. They're kind of a greedy bugger.
Goes to that character?
Yeah. And then you can discard the power off them to draw two cards.
All power?
We're not sure about that yet. What do you think? Do you think it should be a power or all power?
A power for two cards is too cheap. I'd say two power for one card.
Or just all power for two cards?
No, because I don't think it's fair if you chuck one power and get two cards. That sounds a bit overpowered.
But it means that you can't really use that character in any challenges if you want to draw. How about all power for one card?
That's not bad.
He's not a safe body for power. So the point is that
a one cost, zero strength character.
He could be killed or bounced by pretty much every effect.
Anything. Yeah, that's true. That sounds like a very fun imaginary card.
The idea is that he will be called the unofficial champion. I think that's
the name. Yeah, that's the name of the card.
And all of them are going to be sort of like an un-something. So like unsung hero, unofficial champion,
but
unverified winner.
These cards are actually going to be legal, Dave, in all the Beyond the Wall tournaments you attend.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Are you going to print them?
Absolutely.
We are some cards, yeah.
I can't wait to get my playset in the mail.
I've already contacted the artist who does a lot of our cards to commission some artwork of John.
We're going all out. And other than building card decks, that's what we talked about the whole ride on.
And that took 14 hours, huh?
No, 7 hours there. It was much quicker to get there than coming back in the horrible traffic of after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, Sunday's a rough traffic day.
We had some really gross traffic.
So does anyone have any other thoughts on the tournament as a whole before we close this out?
It was a great tournament. You know, I think we ended up with, 42 players total, which is, you know, in line with the number we've gotten for this tournament over the past couple years. We gave away some great prizes. Everyone, I think, went home happy. And we can't wait to...
Longest running Thrones event, right?
Longest running Thrones event. That's right. We've been running it since 2005. This is the 12th year in a row. We will be running another tournament in May or June, the second installment of Dance with Dragons, which should have a similar feel, similar attendance, new art. So if I can plug that, anyone who is sad they missed out on Red Saturday or sad it's over and can't wait for another one, stay on the lookout for Dance with Dragons.
There's been a lot of positive messages about the card art and the card in general on Facebook. People are pretty excited about the New York cards.
That makes me happy. That's what we want.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dave. There were some great insights in there.
It is my pleasure. Thank you guys, as always, for having me.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today, we have all our hosts and a very dangerous unicorn.
I'm assuming the unicorn is one of our guests and not some new mocking title we're using for Sean.
Oh my god, that would be awesome, but no, it is one of our guests.
Oh, okay.
It's Tom, the champion of Red Saturday, and he was playing the whole day with a shirt with a picture of a unicorn on it, and on the little unicorn's horn was tied a knife, and it read, "I will cut you."
Oh, yeah. So is this the North American Star Wars National Champion's strategy for success?
I think his strategy for success was owning people all day. That's what he did to me when we played in the cut.
It's all about making the cut. I think that's what that shirt's about.
I am not the North American Star Wars champion, by the way.
Well, you were something related to that. Continental? Something?
I'm the world champion. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I did not win.
I'm bigger than that.
I'm just saying, I didn't win nationals.
Wait, did the whole world go to Roseville for that tournament?
Everybody.
Because I always find that title funny, that they call it the world championship, but it's held in like middle of nowhere in America.
What do you mean? It's Minnesota. It's like the most popular place.
Center of the world.
That's right.
I didn't realize that.
Minnesota in November. Which makes it even better.
It's neutral territory. Nobody wants to be there. Therefore, everyone's on even footing.
Exactly.
Really, it should be held out in the middle of the ocean somewhere. No man's land. An island.
Or on a boat. Like, giant boat.
So, Tom, this was one of the first tournaments that Valor, getting back on topic, was legal, actually. It was they were handing out alternate art valors so that people could put them in their deck, and they were letting people proxy the newest pack that hadn't come out yet. What was your thoughts in designing your deck? What type of deck did you play?
I played Lanny Kraken, and my thought process was, how do I get the most possible saves in this deck as possible? I never played 1.0, so I never played with Valor before. And yeah, this was this was before it had even released. So like, I didn't get to play a single game with Valor before the start of the tournament. So that was fun. But yeah, just Iron Mines, Bodyguards, Victarion, all the saves.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find that Valor impacted play? So in the way you played, or was the whole point of the deck that it didn't have to impact your play much, at least not defensively,
so,
because you had the saves?
So I played Valor in my deck, mm-hmm. and my plan was basically just try to get as many saves out, protect myself from a Valor, and then if they don't have it, I can use it offensively. And I think literally on the entire day, I played against one person that had it, and it was in the finals in the cut, which was really weird. Like, it seemed like a lot of people built their decks around playing against it and not playing it. So that actually worked out in my favor because I could use it offensively and I didn't have to like save my saves for, you know, their Valor.
So basically your deck was a Lanny good stuff deck with some of the new Great Joy cards, right? Do you think there was anything else that was different other than the fact that you had Valor and these extra saves?
Honestly, the big difference is the stuff that I had to cut, which was really weird. Like, I played no Milks, no Nightmares, which was, like, very weird for me. Like, I like to have all those options of dealing with all the problems, and I didn't have any of them.
Well, Valor deals with a lot of problems.
True. I did still have 3 Treachery and 3 Hands Judgment.
I'd care to maybe back this up just a bit further, and, I mean, you mentioned that you weren't a first edition player, and you weren't intimately familiar with Valor, and these were going to be your first games with Valor. What did you think of Valor prior to playing with it?
Oh, like, I thought I was going to hate it.
Ah, and because it wouldn't allow you to play certain cards, because it would dominate the meta, or because it was going to be an awful card, or?
I always have, like, when I first saw First Snow, I didn't think I would like that card either. I don't like when I see a card that's like, okay, now I'm going to have to expect that every deck's going to play this forever. And I ended up liking First Snow because I just kind of leaned into it, and I played First Snow, and it was great for like a while. And I think that's the same thing's gonna happen for Valor. Like, I'm probably just gonna play a lot of Valor, and that's how I'm gonna deal with it. But it is a card that completely changes the game. Like, you know, decks before Valor, you just can't play them anymore, right? Like, you need to redesign from the ground up. I think
that's fair. And so you thought you were gonna hate it, do you?
I think it's still too early to tell. Like I said, on the day, it did work for me. But it was really weird that I played 9 games on the day and I only saw it once. So that was very surprising to me. I don't know if that's going to be the case, or if that's just maybe because a lot of people didn't have time to practice with it or build around it or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I expected to see it a lot more than that.
Oh, okay. And did you enjoy actually the act of playing the card?
Oh, yeah. I love murder and everything.
Well, that's an important quality for a Thrones player.
Yeah.
So you talked about, you know, during the day only playing one person that had Valor. Do you have any really memorable matches or that you had during the day with the deck? Other people's decks that you found insightful, different, you know, now that the meta had shifted, like you said, people had to redesign and build their decks from the ground up. Did you run into anything that you thought was really cool, or was there a highlight of some matches?
Dave's deck in the finals was really cool, very different. I know he's going to be on this episode as well. I'm not sure if before or after, but I'm sure he'll talk about his deck a bunch, so I don't want to give it away. But he was playing a Lannister Reigns of Castamere deck and had a lot of jump in stuff. It was really cool. Other than that, there was a lot of like Greyjoy splash, right? Like trying to get some saves. Like it seemed like a lot of people were building around Valor. So get the Greyjoys for the saves. Or like a lot of Baratheon for like red keep and just trying to get as much card draw as possible to recover from the Valor. But there wasn't anything like too shocking.
Yeah, I find, and it's, the meta may prove me wrong very quickly. I've only had 2 game nights now with Valor. But I was expecting the first order movement of the meta to be towards the saves and Banner to the Kraken especially. And we're definitely seeing that because that's one of the easiest things to do without radically rethinking what you do. But you mentioned that you weren't running any Milks of the Poppies. Well, if the targets can be killed, or they're not going to last as long, or they won't be saved if they have a Milk on them, Milk doesn't become quite as valuable. And if Milk starts to fade a little bit from the meta, then do we see more of certain cards or less of Confiscation? And I find that those second-order effects, like people running more draw, like people running a slightly lower curve, like potentially First Snow being more impactful if people aren't ready for it because they've got lower curves for Valor, I'm quite excited to see how that plays out because I've really enjoyed my games with Valor so far.
Well, I think it also changes the pacing of games, right? Because people before were overextending. They were just like, if someone wildfires, I'll just keep my three biggest guys and I'm still ahead. But now you get punished way more severely if you're overextending. So you see people playing a different tempo game and holding characters back in hand and protecting them from themselves from intrigue when they wouldn't normally, maybe, because they keep thinking, okay, Valor could come. I have to be ready. I have to, you know, two or three characters I can play out. I have to make sure I have Claim Chud.
A point in that direction, I wasn't sure whether the meta would be fast enough to survive a Valor and not have games go to like 12, 13 plots. In my experiences, we do go more plots, but the game doesn't take longer because your boards are smaller before the Valor and they're smaller after the Valor because you're not overexpanding.
Exactly.
So the decision time for the challenges phase is generally shorter in a Valor meta.
Yeah.
And I actually quite like that. I think the risk of going to the seventh plot makes Valor also more dangerous to carry as just an extra plot in your deck.
You know, and smaller boards actually favor stronger players because you have to use those resources, the sparse resources you have, more wisely. So I think before, when you had a ton of people, you could always just chump block as an auto thing. You're like, oh, I'll just chump block. But when you have only three or four characters on the board, I think those decisions mean more, which I like as well.
I think it also brings back the importance of the seventh plot. You know, in Aegot 1.0, pinning one of your plots was a lot more of a critical decision. Which one would you want to play out again afterwards? I didn't see that happening as much. Usually you'd win before 6, 7 even. But with the Valor and the extension now, where we go more like 9, 12 plots, it's more of a question, more strategic. I could have worded that a lot better.
You could have, but it's okay. The point was made.
I only had one game on the day go past 7 plots, but that was the finals, which is the game that me and my opponent had Valor. So
wait, past 7 plots or past 7 rounds? Because he was playing Reigns of Castamere. 7 plots can be
that
4
that,
rounds, right?
That game actually went.
Alex, you said that really.
10 or 11 rounds, I think.
We know what he meant.
That's surprising, though, that you only had one game go past 7. For me, maybe, and that was my first and only exposure to the Valor meta since I've been sick all that time since New York, all of my games were grinders. I didn't really have any quick games.
And you weren't even running Valor.
No. Yeah, it was one Valor to fear, and it still grinded things out.
For the record, Sean, when we passed that strange hobo that was mumbling to himself on the corner, I said, don't go in there and kiss him. And everyone's like, do it, Sean, do it for $5. And then you just did it. See what happens? Sick for a week.
Should always trust strangers.
Especially hobos.
For $5? Sure. That's American money. That's worth real money now.
That's like $50 for us in Canadian pesos.
Exactly. So I'm curious as to what experiences you've had since the tournament, Tom.
I've really only had one game night since the tournament, and most of the people showed up and kind of like weren't prepared with Valor. So, like, I basically just schooled on everybody because nobody was packing Valor.
I did get that my first game night with Valor as well.
Yeah, like, nobody had updated their deck. So, like, I sit down. I actually brought Dave's deck with me because I wanted to try that. And I had a Tyrell Kraken deck. And it just ran over everybody. And they were like, okay, well, maybe we need to fix our decks. And I'm like, I think so. Like, you know, giant meta-defining card comes out. Maybe update your decks a little bit.
That's fair enough. I mean, it's always interesting to see especially the second edition only players as they'll adapt, because I think they'll also approach it in different ways than we're used to, and we're gonna get schooled with our own Valors as well, us old fogies. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, does anyone else have any other questions?
It's not a question, yeah. But it's a point about that. I think Valor is different in 2.0 and a vast, like it's not your granddad's Valor, right? With the low economy and the curve as it is in 2.0, I feel like it's a different, it's more dire playing it. And it's not as auto-include and crucial. I think you have to be aware of it. You have to act as though they might have it, but I think it's not every deck will be running it.
I think the possibility that Valor could be there is going to affect enough people's play that, like, you know, if your deck builds around using it offensively, fine, include it. But, like, I don't think you need it.
Yeah. In 1.0, I remember there was a player who didn't include Valor, and John gave him a nickname indicating the size of his underwear. So that tells you just how important it was.
It was. It was in 95% of decks, and it belonged in 85%. So, mm-hmm. in first edition, definitely. And I don't think that's the case in second, but I'm glad as well. I think you still want plot deck diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And Valor plus six plots is constraining. So I know that we mentioned this a little bit in the mentor segment, but I'm curious because I didn't get a chance to pester Dave as well. But for each of you, given that two of you were playing Stark and one of you was playing Greyjoy, what was the plot you flipped if you thought your opponent was going to flip Valor? Starting maybe with you, Sean?
If I thought my... It depends on the board. I flipped into Confiscation a few times when they had Bodyguards. That's a good play.
Mm-hmm.
Marched. If they were going to only save a single character that was going to be staying on the board, I'd march that character.
Lots of answers, yeah. And I guess you guys also had time for Wolves in there,
mm-hmm.
if necessary for a reflood. And what about you, Tom? What were you... If you expected a Valor from your opponent, did you change your plots, or did you always have enough saves that you could play with impunity?
I think one game I Valored, one game I marched on a turn that I thought I might get Valored, and I didn't. But most of the time, I just had saves flooding the board, like, so it wasn't a big deal. There was one game that I Valored, and somebody responded with Confiscation, so I was going to keep three characters, and they got me down to two, but it still wasn't enough.
And did your Valor ever get hit by a Varus' Riddle?
Nope.
Ah.
There was one game where somebody played a Varus' Riddle a turn early. They thought I was going to Valor a turn early, and then I did it the next turn. So they tried. One person tried.
I think that plot makes a big difference to Valor in the way I evaluate it from first and second edition.
Mm-hmm.
I just the fear of the double Valor against a 5/6/1/7. It certainly changes the dynamic of that turn.
For sure.
Is there anything you wanted to say, Tom?
I mean, I'm going to a couple Trident events this weekend. I'm going to actually be trying Dave's deck out. So I thought that deck was very, very interesting. So we're going to see how that goes this weekend.
You're voting blue, right?
No.
He's going Maester's Path.
You don't even Maester's remember,
Path
John.
Maester's Path has already won. It doesn't matter.
Yes, so keep voting for it, just in case. You can't just assume things are going to win.
Don't you want to vote for the winner?
Definitely vote in armies.
There we go. See?
Screw those Maesters.
Who wants Maesters?
I don't want Aemon in every deck for the rest of forever. Like, that dude annoys me. Like,
everyone seems to be assuming that the agenda will allow you to play all out of faction Maesters. That's not necessarily what it'll do.
Didn't they already announce that?
Nope.
Like, I swear that they announced that.
Not to my knowledge.
I thought somebody had told me at some point that they announced that whichever the factions wins, that's going to be the effect, and then there'd be some additional effect for that card.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense, but I haven't seen any official announcement for that.
Yeah, we all agree at least that any knight out of any faction would be annoying as hell because the mountain would be everywhere.
Oh, wait. I have to change my vote. The mountain... is God. Why would we anger him by not letting him be everywhere?
Well, John, you probably thought that the mountain was an army as well.
He's better than an army.
Technically, he should be.
Yeah. He's an army crusher.
We can get that errated.
We can get...
John,
errata would be right.
You can still play him out of your Lannister army deck. Don't worry about it.
It's true.
This is a special recording because this is the first time all of the Beyond the Wall guests have been together with at least one of the mentors. Is that exciting, Matt?
I like how the caveat still has to be with at least one of the mentors.
Wait, who are the Beyond the Wall guests? I thought we were the Beyond the Wall hosts.
I'm the guest. Wait, I'm a host now?
I mean, you're on more than Sean.
That's true. Oh, wow. I guess that makes me a host de facto.
Have you just slowly replaced me with Matt?
You got to start showing something, something, this, something, something, that. No, in all seriousness, though, it's great to having everyone here because I'm running out of tasks to give you. So this was like, you know, it's all, and now I can push it all onto Alex and Sean to come up with like things to make you do next week. Because Matt, from what I understand, you're winning.
I'm doing pretty well, actually. The lessons I've learned, I've been taking a lot of them to heart. I've been trying to get in as many games as possible with a lot of different decks. Things are going very well up until, well, very recently, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, let's talk about that now. So how are things going until recently?
Oh, Lannister. What the heck? This box. Now that this box is out and I got local people, they're all playing like Lannister Winter, Lannister Reigns of Castamere, and it's like the power level of Lannister has been dialed up to 17.5. It's awful. I haven't seen so many treacheries.
I think between the Clansmen, Reigns, the new Cersei, there's a whole lot of new flavor of Lannister out there. Whereas before, you kind of had the one or two powerful versions. They got a whole smattering of variety.
Well, not only that, even a lot of the old cards that have been enhanced by some of the new cards from the Lannister box. For example, a Reigns of Castamere deck with three of the core Cersei plus Trial by Combats plus a lot of two claim plots, you know, did really well locally. But the thing is, it's been enhanced by things like Chella. Chella in a Reigns of Castamere deck is pretty nuts.
See, I'm curious as to you saying that all, with lots of claim two plots in that deck, because if you have the claim two plot, you have to flip out of it before claim, you flip into scheme.
Well, they don't necessarily trigger Reigns of Castamere on their two claim turn. It's just they have that option there whenever they want to, they can just mid challenge, you know, hit a wildfire, mid challenge, hit a filthy accusations.
Yeah, it is very powerful, you know, flipping into a wildfire and then still getting that military attack or military claim. I've been seeing that a lot in the Targaryen Reigns decks where they, you know, flip into a wildfire, then thanks to Drogo, machine gun two more kills off, and they basically put you in this really bad position where they march next turn and you got like the zero state board. You kind of have to try to claw your way back, and it can be really tough.
Yeah, I've also been seeing a lot of situations where, say, Chella gets powered up mid challenge, and then there are three characters left, you know, on the opponent's side. Then they have to claim one of them. Then intimidate happens because Chella got intimidate mid challenge, things like that.
I mean, I've played two games against Chella, and I got a ward on her once. Basically lost my opponent the game, handing me a nicely readied Chella. ward is just such a deterrent to that card.
Yeah, but with the jumping Clansmen, a lot of time, they're just jumping Chella in, powering her up, doing the intimidate, and then jumping her. She's back out. Thanks to... So you won something, Matt.
Yes, a couple of weeks ago, I, after receiving my homework assignment from Mr. Aaron Glazier to stop playing so aggressively, I decided to completely toss that out and build an aggressive Baratheon deck. To be precise, I built Baratheon Kraken, one of my loves, you know, of this game. I just love the synergy between Asha and Melisandre and Neil and Intimidate and Stealth. It all seems to combine together, and then you back it up with some save effects, you know, to become this nice package. And then on top of it all, you get Maester Wendemir, who's great in Baratheon, and you've got, strangely enough, people ask me this all the time, the Lordsport Shipwrights in Baratheon. Oh, so useful! You can kneel out Gaston Greys and High Gardens and all those things that just wreck your day.
Let's talk a little bit about the homework assignment. So for those that don't know, Aaron assigned Matt to go play in a more defensive manner because he thought Matt was too aggressive. So Matt bunkered down and played some decks that were very defensive in nature, right, Matt?
Yeah, primarily got quite a few games in with Lucas Sidlaski's Baratheon Night's Watch deck that he took to Worlds. That one seemed really interesting, and it seemed familiar enough for me to try because it was Baratheon, but yet it seemed very different because it had a lot of passive power gain. Like, it has one copy of Thorn Smallwood and one copy of The Wall. Only one copy of The Wall. Strange. But no, I understand it now, having played it in a few games.
But it's a deck that's definitely very, very defensive. And how did you feel playing it?
Oh, man. I felt awful because I wasn't drawing any cards. I didn't get a red keep, and that deck only has two red keeps in it. So I wasn't drawing very much, and I just felt like I was just hunkering down and locking in, you know, and hoping that the wall doesn't get knelt, or hoping that I could flip a Winter Festival and my opponent doesn't flip a Summer Plot. It felt a little less fluid because I'm so used to playing things like Close Call and Time of Plenty and Support of the People to really get my Baratheon train rolling.
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting things a lot of players learn about themselves, and I think this was a good experience for you for this, and I think others might get some value from it, is that we all have a play style, a natural play style. Like, Alex, what's your play style?
I have a natural play style?
Yeah, you have a natural play style.
I have trouble picking that, because recently I've been playing, for most of 2.0, I've just been playing whatever falls into my hands, and I'm almost a training tool for the people in my meta. So I have five decks built, and I ask my opponent which one he wants me to play. So I've
never seen you play like generic good. You always play something that's fun and a little. There has to be a little bit of wacky in there, Alex.
Okay, there's a little bit of wacky in there. That's probably entirely true.
Certainly for first edition, it was never, I certainly would not fall under the DC envelope.
And I think every player has that, and it's important for them to kind of figure out what it is they are. If they're a highly aggressive player like you, Matt, if mm-hmm. they're a highly defensive player like some people are, or if they're a little wacky like Alex, and play to that. Build decks that you're going to enjoy, and play to your strengths, because every deck, depending on the player, doesn't work out the same, because you just won't think along the lines, and if you're uncomfortable thinking along the lines in a big tournament, you're just going to lose out. So I think it was a good lesson, and I think you do have to think about those other playstyles to know how to attack them. So when you're not in a tournament, it's good to be out of that comfort zone and trying things out. But when you get to a tournament, I always suggest playing, you know, what you're really going to really, really going to enjoy, and something that fits with your more natural playstyle.
Yeah, and speaking of, a defensive deck that I tried that I actually really liked was Thomas Elbeck style Night's Watch Fealty, where you run two counting coppers and you really rely on those Old Forest Hunters to power your economy. And it's really all about just digging for Cravens. So that one I found interesting because I got to build a nice little tableau of locations to just kind of get the vice grip going.
See, yeah, I enjoyed that deck immensely for what it taught me about the double counting coppers. I will admit that it is a little too defensive for me to enjoy playing, but it's a stellar deck, and I've played it probably 20 times to try and learn how it worked. But yeah, that certainly falls outside of the kind of playstyle I normally go for.
I've also begun to really enjoy Martell, the judo house, as we've been calling it locally, where you know, you got to lure your opponent in, and then you just turn things back on them, and all of a sudden you're flipping first snow of winter, and you've got four characters that are going to stay around, and your opponent's only going to have two, and then you just seize control of the game from there.
The judo house. So, Matt, we had some other homework. We asked you to watch a few more shows, mm-hmm. watch the World Finals, and were you following Shalik as well?
I was following Stalik as closely as I could. I was absolutely rooting for Evan Sorgeard. He's become a friend of mine after I visited Scotland last year. I'm so glad he made top 8. Go, Evan. And he was playing Baratheon, which makes me very happy.
Yeah, Baratheon is the story of... It was statistically the best pick going into Stalik. All the stats for the Lions of the Rock meta had Vera overrepresenting by like three times more than Lanny. It was really the deck to play, and Stalik wasn't really any different. There was a lot of Vera in the cut, much more than you'd expect at random.
Which is great to hear. I was a bit surprised to see Yannis Ropert's Baratheon Sun list, which is getting a lot of activity on ThronesDB lately. And that's a strange deck. It's got one Robert Baratheon. That's just blasphemy. Someone needs to, I don't know how you sleep at night, Yannis.
I mean, Matt, I hate to tell you this. Our version had no Robert Baratheon in it.
What?
That at Montreal.
Oh my God! How do you?
No.
I don't understand.
And the big secret of Two Wildfires were out, and he still did it, man.
Oh yeah, Two Wildfire. I can totally understand that one. Yeah.
The double Wildfire with all the attachment controls. It's pretty much the deck we played, just with the new cards that came out in the chapter pack since. I was really happy to see it do well because
we couldn't crack it. So you know, to say it was pretty much the deck is not a big enough nod to the builder, because we couldn't crack it and he did. So I mean, good on him. That's amazing. It's
not to take anything away from him, but I was excited to see the deck perform well. I knew it was a good deck.
Yeah, we knew there was something there, and we were so close. We just couldn't get it to beat Stark. And I mean, maybe that was still the problem because Florian beat it. You know, with Stark.
Oh, yeah. He did mention in his write-up that he couldn't find Melisandre in order to kneel Greywind. I don't know what kind of situation he was in where he absolutely had to get into Greywind knelt, but...
Greywind was allowing him to stand all his other characters probably for multiple challenges because he was eating his own guys.
Oh, that's right. I haven't really paid close attention to Florian's list. Was he using Jon Snow at all?
He had two copies of Jon Snow, yeah.
Okay, because I was thinking, oh, well, if you... I mean, Greywind, yeah, he can eat his own guys and stand everybody up. He only really has like three targets for it, you know, because if he has Winterfell out, he can only eat the stewards. So Greywind can get kind of limiting, where Jon Snow, oh man, sky's the limit.
The most surprising aspect to me of the way that Barrow-Sun shaked out is primarily, I mean, it's maybe a bit tangential, but is the fact that it has 1.5 renowns and no Dom tech. So the power climb really has to be quite tricky. You have to play this deck quickly if you're going to avoid time wins.
Okay.
And I heard that he had, and that was the problem that Sean had, right? You had how many time wins, Sean? Two that day or something? Yeah, we couldn't get it through, but I think that was just pure practice. I think that's all on the pilot. I think he played a billion times with that deck until he could just go.
Well, he didn't get a single time win in Stalic, so
he
certainly found the openings. But when you see Robert, no stand effects for Robert, and the Knight of the Sun as your only two sources of acceleration, really, that's surprising to me.
Yeah, I guess he was relying on, I guess, Quinton can get stealth. I mean, Robert Baratheon has renown.
Davos has stealth, and the icon removal attachments will give you unopposed. So
yeah, so maybe unopposed power is what he was going after.
That's definitely, but it's still a long grind.
Yeah.
And it auto loses to Night's Watch, doesn't it?
No, we did really well against Night's Watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, back then, Night's Watch wasn't a thing.
Yeah, it was. It had
they
the
were missing a few of the cards.
They didn't have Kraven.
But
that's true. Yeah. Yeah, Kraven might swing it in its favor. Yeah. I think
I played a Night's Watch in the first round, and I was only able to beat him through using some advanced trickery. I don't know if you remember that match, but it was something to do with Davos's stealth. And
yeah, that's how you do it, stealth.
So we were talking a little bit about Valor, but do we want to go off and talk about Valor here, or should we focus on Mentor? What do you guys think?
I am willing to be mentored on how to make use of Valor and how to protect against Valor.
It's not a bad idea for a lesson, right? Maybe go do your homework on Valor, make a deck that could be post-Valor proof.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. Sean just threw you homework.
Excellent. No, this is great because my first store championship is going to be Saturday, December 3rd, 2 days after Valor Morghulis comes out. So I'm in full-on Rocky Balboa training mode at this point, and that can include Valor Morghulis and King Stannis because we're finally getting King Stannis.
We are getting a King Stannis. I would like to start by saying I don't think any of us really knows the impact that Valor is going to have. We have a lot of experience playing against it in first edition, and we know a lot of the kinds of things that it does to the game, but it'll take a while to shake out because people will be including it in decks it doesn't belong or using it at the wrong times, and that can really throw off someone who has figured out how to use it correctly. And I'm not saying I am that person yet. A large part of what Valor did in first edition was cause you to have to pace yourself and use only the resources needed for that turn. And so if you've played Tamas's deck and so on, you realize that, you know, you need these two rolls. You know which card you're digging for. You know which ones are needed for this situation. And you're just trying to deny him more power than what you're getting. You're not trying to win by five. You're not trying to get his board down to zero. You're not doing any of these things. And post-Valor situation is very much like that. You don't want to spend the nightmares on a tiny advantage on turn two when it might be a game-changing advantage on turn five. And so you have to ration yourself more in a Valor environment. And that can be hard for aggressive decks.
I see. It kind of reminds me a little bit about you saying pacing yourself about how to make good use of Wildfire Assault. There's some pacing that goes on there.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the biggest comparison to Valor. Although Valor is Wildfire Assault on steroids because you're getting a more extreme economy hit and you're getting a more extreme board wipe.
Yeah, this is true.
You also can't really use Valor aggressively to take first player. A lot of people did that in 2E. You want to go first, you flip Wildfire, and you have a pretty good chance of it.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, I remember in discussions with some of my local players that I was starting to compare it to First Snow of Winter, actually, except so with First Snow of Winter, you're trying to get yourself into a place where post First Snow, things are skewed towards your board. But with Valor Morghulis, I think that it is much less clear when a good time to play Valor Morghulis is than with First Snow. With First Snow, it's like, oh, I have three characters that are going to survive and you have one. All right, I'll flip First Snow. But with Valor Morghulis, it's, you could totally screw yourself by playing it.
Two gold and the zero claim are both very, very large tempo hits. And so the advantage you need to get from playing it has to be proportionately large. But, I mean, it can still be card advantage. Your opponent has six characters and you have two. That costs him four more cards than it costs you. You know, you can value that at different points. But the other thing is, after a Valor, you need to be able to put characters on the board. It doesn't matter much whether they're strong characters. It just matters that you need enough to be able to, after your opponents, for instance, be able to hit him with claim, ideally from two or three different sides, to pop open his post-Valor game, and he's going to try and get characters to deny you that claim on that one turn where it's extra impactful, sort of like for Snow Winter.
Okay.
So I don't know what it would, John. You're the one guiding these segments. What sort of decks do you expect to see Valor in right now?
I mean, there's a bunch of obvious ones, right, where people are going to be sticking them into Greyjoy decks because they have a ton of saves, and you'll see a lot of. But like you were saying, Alex, big draw decks. People like Tyrell can play to Valor well, and I think Stark plays against Valor super well. I think Stark's a sleeper against Valor because of all the immune to plot effects, and I say all. There's a couple, but that's enough, I think, to keep extra characters on the board.
And Summer is a phenomenal replay.
Summer's so good for recovery. Yeah. I think Stark is the sleeper faction against Valor, but they're not playing it themselves. Because if they play it themselves, then a lot of that stuff doesn't work out.
A lot of the protection doesn't. And also, you can't flip into Time for Wolves on the same turn you flip into Valor.
So, I have a question for you now, Sean. Have you picked what you're going to be playing in New York?
I haven't. I've got a couple options. I like Greyjoy, as you mentioned. I'm a big Greyjoy fanboy. I think this is going to be the rise of the Kraken, so to speak.
Can I ask you a question, Sean? Can Matt pick from those options what you're going to play?
Can he? I'm not even sure what I want to. I want to do my tried and true method of changing my deck in the car on the way and building it.
Oh man, will you build my deck for me in the car on the way? Because I haven't picked a deck yet.
Yeah.
John, just play the Barisun control. And swap one Wildfire for a Valor.
No, don't play that. Play my Baratheon Kraken deck and swap the Wildfire for Valor Morghulis.
No, that's for Sean.
I was actually,
it's got Greyjoy. I can't play that.
I was really tempted to do either Bera Kraken or Kraken Baron. Bera, you know, whichever yep. way they go, you know. I'd have to play that out a bit first. I also was messing around with a deck that uses Jaqen and Miri with Greyjoy. Because Jaqen's coming out with his next pack with Valor as well, and he'll be legal at New York. And I think with raiding longships, getting your Miris and your Jaqens off is really easy. Also, Old Wick.
It's a brutal cost curve.
It is a brutal cost curve. Doesn't Old Wick help with getting off the win alone combo because it returns
yes.
the character? So you could have some surprise Drowned Men and Drowned Priests pop out to give them a little hand.
Yeah, Old Wick seems like a lot of fun.
Yeah, Old Wick really seems good, actually. I think there's a lot of value in Old Wick. But,
yeah. Ambushing from your dead pile for zero? That sounds great.
And then if you win, it comes to your hand? Oh, man, it's horrible.
There just isn't enough Drowned God right now to do it.
Well, aren't the main armies Drowned God?
They are.
And the three priests, the guys that give +1 to each Drowned?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then Aaron Dampair?
Yes, the new Aaron Dampair is the one I would run, too.
You got at least six or seven Drowned Gods, probably.
Yeah, three Drowned Men, three Priests of the Drowned God, and then two copies of Aaron Damfair. That's eight right there.
And you haven't even played the Crown yet, Alex. Well, seven characters, you'll get one.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. Especially with Valor in the environment, you just have to play one of them. You know he's going to die at some point.
Yeah, and a couple Wildfires. Wildfire Valor.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Targaryen summer deck I was playing a couple of months ago, where I was doing three copies of Fire and Blood because I would try to get my little hatchlings killed, knowing that I could just ambush them out for one gold. Yeah.
So here's the question. A lot of the anti-Valor game involves picking the right plot when your opponent is going to Valor. And this is twofold. It's either picking the right plot so that if he Valors, you do fine, or if he doesn't Valor, you're in a state where you're doing fine as well. So what we already mentioned a Time for Wolves. What are some of the other anti-Valor plots that we have out there right now?
Varys's Riddle.
Agreed, yeah. Wholeheartedly.
You can mess up their save. If they're planning to use, say, Bodyguard or Iron Mines to save one of their characters, Varys's Riddle will mess that up because all of a sudden their board's getting wiped twice.
And you've got more gold.
Six initiative and five gold.
Yes.
So yep. Wholeheartedly. It's a really good play. And generally a safe one if they're not going to Valor. So.
I've been thinking about calling the banners out of Lannister. So you can have gold for treacheries to cancel saves like Iron
Man. Oh, that sounds.
I like marched. You know, you go first. You let their valor go off, and you march that key character they saved.
So I think that's the bigger thing that you'll find to make a deck valor proof isn't necessarily that you have to drastically change the deck or you have to banner to Kraken. It's just you can counter valor by just playing well, making sure you have characters to put back on the board after the valor, always in hand, and knowing when your opponent, getting the feel for when your opponent's going to valor, and playing a plot that gives you a tremendous advantage against them.
I mean, I remember in first edition there was lots of times where you just do the double valor call. You knew the other opponent had to valor, and he had a couple saves or dupes on board, and you're like, I'm going to valor too. We're going to kill all those dupe characters because they only have enough to save themselves once.
I think unexpected delay could be a good valor counter. You return your most important character if they have like nothing but chuds. Doesn't matter if they return a character.
Unexpected delay saw some very interesting play with Stalic.
I really loved the one deck. Oh, I can't remember which one it was. It was running two of them, and it would do it back to back, and it was pushing for initiative wins. So he could determine, and it was playing really cheap attachments on his characters, so that he could make his opponent choose first. Only his characters were eligible, and then he could pick a secondary character, essentially returning his opponent's worst character and best character every time he flipped unexpected. It was really, really smart.
I really like unexpected delay. I love it in Melee so much. I like it in Joust too.
Would we call
I
it?
Think a, there's some interesting stuff to do.
Would we call it an unexpected hit?
Well, one of my favorite anti-Valor plays, though, I think, will be if you have Barristan on the board,
yep,
and you think your opponent's going to flip Valor, you flip Filthy Accusations.
Yeah.
If he flips Valor, then you kneel Barristan, and he gets to save one of your characters. And if he doesn't, you knelt one of his characters, and you continue to maintain a superior board state. Yeah. It's just a fun, safe plot to play if you expect a Valor or, you know.
Yeah, some people I've seen go like really extreme. They're like, I'm going to use the save regardless, so I'm going to kneel him, you know, after the stand phase with my one of my events to kneel mm-hmm. one of their good characters, just in case they don't Valor. And if they do, great, then I get a save.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had one friend suggest a pretty elaborate combo. So what you do is you have Barristan Selmy, and you have the new Aaron Damfair. So what you do is you you use your Iron Mind.
Yes.
Use your Iron Mind. You save your Barristan Selmy. He comes out knelt. Then you stand Barristan Selmy to save someone else.
Yeah. Ta-da! It is amusing.
It's fun and exciting.
I'm looking forward to that kind of combo. I think I might be playing a little bit of Stag and a little bit of Squid. And
yeah, there you go.
Oh,
yeah.
Some other anti-Valor ones that I think are worth mentioning. Fortified Position, if they're counting on saves from characters. Heads on Spikes, if they're likely to be holding characters in hand.
To play after Valor.
Which they sort of have to do. A Heads on Spikes can give you... gives you the initiative you need, it gives you enough gold to get a good character or two, and can pull out that character. So that can be really good.
I would say claim two plots if you think you have characters.
If you're going to maintain characters, yes.
Because
if
just...
you're not, then it's something like Here to Serve or Time for Wolves will allow you to reflood in the way you want.
Yeah, Rise of the Kraken seems like it could be really interesting for just punishing of someone playing Valor Morghulis.
Yeah, saying, all right, fine, I'm going to get two unopposed this turn. You're screwed.
That seven gold plot where you have to sacrifice one of your characters. People love that for Valor.
If you call it right.
Yeah, well, if you don't.
You're Stark or whatever, then, oh no, your Caitlyn from Wolves just got another power. What have you done?
Yeah, and the rest of the time you can sack your Ed or whatever that you don't want to replay, and then you have seven gold in the Valor turn, so you can really outplay.
Now, there was a version of this play in first edition. I don't think it exists yet, but there's consideration for political disaster. If we start seeing a lot of Greyjoy play, flipping political disaster allows you to win initiative, resolve it first, and if they're going to keep their iron mines, then they're losing all their economy.
Oh, base. That's mean. That's really funny, but that's great. Oh, this reminds me, before we wrap up, I have one very important question. So in my travels, I see this question come up a lot. If my opponent sets up Tywin Lannister, Reducer, and Rose Road, do you Valor first turn?
No.
No.
Okay, you heard it here, everybody. Don't do that.
No, Valoring turn one like that, you can only strike.
You can't.
Unless you set up the Arbor, in which case maybe.
Oh, okay.
You have to be, like, I would think it's a very tough game for you to do that.
Yeah.
I think if you set up the Arbor, you can. I don't think there's any other setup.
If you're playing, like, a Tyrell Night's Watch and you've got the Arbor and the Wall.
Or Highgarden, even.
Yeah.
Yeah, Highgarden, I think, might be pretty good in a post-Valor environment because you can just...
Picking up the single character.
Yeah. You can help you recover from... you can help you recover because your opponent's not able to hit you for military quite as easily.
All right, well, people are still reeling from the Valor release and the There's My Claim release, but of course, the wheel grinds ever forward. I think there's a real literary quote in there somewhere, but I'm just getting it wrong.
The weaves as the wheel wills.
No, I wasn't thinking about wheels. No, I was thinking about grinding, not weaving. But so we have two cards to spoil from Chapter Pack 5. I just had to check the numbers on the cards to actually verify that. And
let me fix it for you, Alex. The wheel turns and ages come and pass, leaving memories
legends,
faith, and myth, and even myth is long forgotten.
Even he gets his directions messed up and all sorts of... I never forgave Robert Jordan for book 10 or 11, whichever one it was that started halfway through the previous book. And I haven't read anything since.
I never got past book 8.
Yeah, you're not missing anything.
No, you're missing everything. The last book
good. You're wrong, Sean.
I read the whole thing. Man, that was a good series.
You poor thing.
No, it wasn't. It was a bad series. It would have been a great series if it was 5 books.
And that the first book wasn't quite so derivative of Lord of the Rings. That would help too. All right, on to Thrones. We have been given 2 cards to spoil, both the Barra cards. We have one that's much more Shaga and one that's less Shaga. So, Sean, you want to read out the one that's less Shaga?
Less Shaga, but I like the Shaga. All right.
Well, yeah.
Okay, I'll switch with you.
No, you can read the Shaga. I'll read the Jamie card. I'm assuming the Jamie one is the event, because the event is so good.
No, you got
the
it
event
backwards.
Is really? Definitely Shaga.
Yeah.
But it,
so you can do the event. I'll do the non-Shaga.
All right.
The non-Shaga is Sir Davos Seaworth. He's 6 cost. He's a bicon with a military and power icon. He's 4 strength. He's loyal. He has stealth. And his reaction is, after Sir Davos Seaworth bypasses a non-loyal character using stealth, either draw 1 card or gain 1 gold.
And the flavor quote is, I've broken laws, but I've never felt evil until tonight. And it's clearly art of him rowing Melisandre into Dragonstone.
Yeah, so why is he 1 more cost than Tyrion or Tywin or whoever that silly stealth guy is from Lannister that gets 2 gold when he does intrigue?
Look, because that card's over. Because you can reduce him with fealty. Now, honestly, I agree. There are things I like about this card. I actually think the mechanic is neat. Triggering off bypassing non-loyal characters and then giving him a sort of draw or gold option. I think that it's nice that they're maintaining stealth as generally a faction weakness in Barra, so when they add it, it's because
one of the
previous
characters already has it.
Exactly. Yeah. All of that seems like good design, having this one loyal versus the other one. All great, except that this card is probably overpriced by at least 1, and certainly just, I don't think, good enough. It's the sort of draw 1 card... Bad Roderick, kind of, with a keyword, but no higher. No, you can't tease him on defense, and the other Davos is better in a Valor meta.
Yeah, and they should have probably just put him 4 cost and gave him 3 strength at the other Davos, but with, you know, instead of a save, he gets this other effect, and then there'd be a choice point.
Yeah.
Especially with loyalty, because then you're like, oh, if I'm fealty, I'm really going to, you know, go with the new one, maybe. But right now, he's at least 1, maybe 2, too expensive.
On the bright side, there's no limit on his reaction. So if you can restand him somehow.
Okay, but he's not as good as, like, the Tywin who can react to your opponents.
Yeah, the Tyrion.
Stealth. If it said, every time a character is stealthed, then non-loyal character stealth, draw a card or gain a gold, I'd be happier with him.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Certainly be playing for a Barra Kraken or something like that.
Yeah. Right.
But no. Yeah, I think, unfortunately, he's just not good enough.
Yeah, we won't see him that often. He's just bad.
Which is a shame. I like the art a lot. I think it's really good art.
The art's really good. Card is
it
bad,
does bring up a finicky rules question, though. So now when you're stealthing people, you're going to have to individually declare who's being stealthed by whom.
You've already had to do that.
I mean, you did, in a
with
sense.
Ghost.
But
people. Okay, with Ghost, fair enough.
Or with the Wolves of Winterfell or whatever they're called, the Wolves of the North.
Oh, now we have the one with the minus strength. So it's not a new interesting rule question. It's a very old.
Well, what happens
kind of
when,
from the core set?
What happens if you weren't paying attention for the last year and a half, and then you stumble on this card?
Now you're confused.
But what happens if somebody declares stealth just kind of in a broad sense, and then you call them on it? Are they allowed an opportunity to choose, or do you choose for them?
It's a reaction. So, I mean, Ghost, a lot of times it was the reaction. They'd be like, okay, I'm going to stealth, and Ghost is going to react, and you'd point to the card. I think you're going to do a similar thing here.
Yeah, I don't see this one being logistically a problem.
Yeah, and me neither.
We'll see what Greg Atkinson has to say.
All right, so that means Sean gets to give us the Shaga card.
All right, yeah, you guys are totally right. I got a little mixed up here. So it's an event. It costs X. Ritual of Rylor. I think I'm saying that right. We'll see. It's a Baratheon card, obviously. It has Rylor itself, and it says, reaction, after you win dominance, choose X standing Rylor characters. Each of those characters gains one power. The morning air was dark with the smoke of burning gods.
This is a cool card.
Very cool art, too. I like the, is that the mother with a sword in her, burning Melisandre,
yeah,
burning all the altars?
Yeah, and a nice perspective on it. No, I mean,
yeah, I like it.
So basically, you pay X gold to choose X standing Rylor characters if you win dominance, and those characters each gain a power. This can really get you, it's got such a high ceiling, but there's a fair bit of work to get that there.
Likely you're getting 2 to 4 power here.
And even then, that's 4 gold spent, and you have to ensure that you're winning dominance with standing Rylor characters. That's a lot of work put into that.
Yeah.
But it's trait synergy, it's got a really high ceiling, makes you want to build around it, and it gives you power, which is what wins you the game, and it does it so independently of challenges. And that's always stronger than it looks.
Also, I'll see people just spending 1 gold, getting 1 power on Melisandre, and just kneeling something. I mean, if you need to play that Rylor card, you need to play that Rylor card.
Well, kneeling something in dominance, not very useful.
Unless you have Stan the Man out.
Unless you have Stannis, that's true.
Are we going to see a Baratheon Dominance melee deck?
That can take this really high? I think if you have too many... I think this card does mean that if you sit on, 5 gold and you have 5 standing Rylor characters, someone's
going to throw
a military challenge at you. Or maybe loot will become good, just to use your 4 standing gold or your 4 remaining gold.
You heard it here. Loot is now mandatory.
I do think that it's also nice that this will synergize with, for instance, the Fiery Followers, which will always be standing when you get to Dom. So.
And they need a little bit boost, because I think the newer Eshai characters and Rylor characters are better.
Has a slight edge. Well, better. Slight edge.
The Milton icon is nice.
Yeah.
No, I like this card a lot. I think it's excellent design that ties a couple of, two, the Baratheon
themes together, yeah.
Yeah, which is nice. Really nice design. Lovely card.
It's too bad they designed that table so bad. Yeah.
you can't win them all. All right, we have one more segment to share with you guys. A few weeks back, and we posted on our Facebook group that we had received some cards from Michael Spaulding, who is the Citadel Quartermaster. Citadel-Quartermaster.com, and he had sent us some samples of his work to talk about and review, and by us, I mean me, because he figured he should send it to the most important person on the podcast. But we're all looking up at his website as well, and we'll have some quick words about all that. I'd like to start off by saying that the materials arrived in excellent condition, and the packaging, especially for the house card, which if you can look at our Facebook page, wrapped in brown paper with a wax seal that looked like it was a seal of the hand, literally used as a seal. So that was very neat to have. Wax seals are actually a quick way to my heart. I really like them. So that's a great start to that. So we have in hand power tokens, so wooden power tokens, laser cut, and sides are burnt black, which is quite nice. And the tokens are, they're light, they're wood. I tend to prefer heavier tokens. So we have the Barra tokens, which are quite clearly a stag. We have a faction card, which is one of the wooden double-sided faction cards. And that the one we have here is the Night's Watch. Again, the cutout is very precise, and the inside of the cutout is black, which looks quite good because of the way it was cut. And the last thing we have is a granite Lannister house card. So there's some good, some bad. The quality of the components is excellent. The designs are in front of me here are really good. I do have some design questions, like the, if you guys can see the double-sided Game of Thrones faction cards, it seems like placing power on a card that has a cut-out hole is not ideal.
Yeah, I don't even like the look of the cut-out hole, but I think that's just a personal thing. I prefer, you know, a carving or an engraved instead of a full cut-through. And yeah, I would think your power tokens, depending on their size, would just fall through.
Especially with the Stark one, it's kind of a larger hole in the center. I could see losing a token in there or getting one on the edge, putting another one down and sort of flipping it, losing track of power by mistake.
Yeah, I mean, it is nice to have it be double-sided, and I actually think the font choice is really good. Mm-hmm. The bordering on the cards is also quite neat and unique to each faction. The ones we have for Night's Watch look superb. But yeah, I do have some questions as to whether I would put tokens on them and whether they would fall into the bird. And the bird is not the largest of those designs, so a bit of a caveat there, depending on where you keep your power tokens and how large they are, that would be something to consider, I think. The actual power tokens that he supplies do not fall through, so that's the whole point. You buy an assorted set of the cards that are large enough and the power tokens that won't fall through.
That makes sense. If you get the house card, you probably want to go with the full theme, the wooden tokens.
Yeah, I think that probably is pretty fitting. And he does have the single-sided Game of Thrones faction cards that aren't cut all the way through, again, with the same designs, so that's probably an option as well. Won't allow you to use it as a banner for the watch. Then again, the cutout versions, using them as a banner seems to make more sense because you're not going to put power tokens on it. So I guess that's another take on it. The pièce de résistance that we're looking at here is the Granite House card, though. The Granite House card, which came in that lovely package I was telling you about, has a nice heft to it, some weight. It actually feels much better than the official Granite House cards that FFG used to do. The back of the card has a sort of like cork-based seal so that it's not actually directly putting granite on your table. It's got something to soften that impact, but it doesn't detract from the feel of the card, and even that back padding has the engraving of Citadel Quartermaster, which looks really good. The weight is great, the precision of the work on the granite is excellent, and the design that we have is the Lannister Lion, which is very reminiscent of the house card, with a nice exaggerated tongue that some people dislike, but I actually like a lot because it calls to mind heraldry from that era, which always had these kinds of things. And it says, Promo, Hear Me Roar on it. So it's very similar to the version you'd find on their site, but ours is labeled with the tag for a promo. And this, I think, is definitely impressive work and will look fantastic on the table. And no complaints about where you could keep your power on it. It's big, it's satisfying, it's $40. So I don't think you would go for a full set. I think it would very much be for the faction that you're keen on, if granite is fitting for you. However,
they did have them at Red Saturday, so we got to see one of these up front. They had one of the foil versions, and is the one you have foiled or just engraved?
You can do foil on granite?
Yeah, you can do it by using like a Cricut cutter or something. I don't know what he's using, but
I had no idea. No, this is. I mean, it has the surfaces that have been either etched, but they're reflective surfaces, and so you can see they look gold and. But when you say foil, I'm not entirely sure what you mean.
What I mean. That is a foil when you have that. Oh, okay. It looks cool.
Yeah, if it's reflective, yeah.
It is reflective, yeah. Yeah, so it's not just painted on. It's certainly more than that. There's a little bit you can feel when moving your finger across the granite onto the decal or whatever it is. There's a slight change in surface, but it's like metal was embedded into the card. It's a really nice feel, actually. These are fantastic.
Yeah, when I checked out the one that Dan had at his house for the prize, it was well done. So
they did a custom one, I think. They took the New York logo from the back of their custom cards, and they actually had it, I think, mentioning Red Saturday. I might be wrong.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
I think also, I just went on the website and I took a look. It is confirmed gold foil. It says sealed with polyurethane to protect the foil.
Okay. Yeah, then foil is the right word. Now, with all that said, I think Sean had stumbled upon something, as had John, that I think bears mention.
Yeah, so one of our listeners sent me a message when they saw the house cards, indicating that the Targaryen house card design actually comes from something else, specifically How to Train Your Dragon. And I was a bit skeptical at first because you always have to treat everything with a bit of cynicism. But I went and I looked it up, and you can find logos that look very much like that one. This one's a little more simplified. So, for example, there's a little flame in the center where I think there's something else in the How to Train Your Dragon one, but it's pretty spot on as far as silhouette goes. Which is a little alarming if you're paying $40 for a house card, because I know when I try to do custom cards, and a lot of the community, when they do custom cards, they try to ensure the artists are being compensated. And for a work this expensive, especially, you'd want something with commissioned art or original artwork. And I don't know. I haven't asked Michael, but I don't think that these are all entirely original designs. If one is questionable, there, it opens up questions for the rest. And I think John, I mentioned it to John, and he looked into it, and
well, I just looked at some of them, and I had been doing pumpkins with my kids at the time, and the Stark tree keyed off to me because I had remembered that I had seen a stencil for it. But actually, I've been searching for the last 2 minutes to try to refine that stencil, and I haven't. So it might just be that it looks similar to a stencil I used. Like what Sean was saying, it's hard to tell. It'd be nice to know where he got the artwork. You know, somewhere on his website, just saying, you know, this artwork was from this artist, or I made it myself, or whatever, and share a little link to it so that people would feel, you know, they wouldn't worry about such things.
I think
that would be my suggestion.
That's probably a very fair point. I think it is worth mentioning the source of the product or of the design in these elements. And I mean, it's obvious that if you're going to draw a Tyrell logo, it's going to be inspired by certain specific things, and it's going to look very similar to, you know, other ones with whatever stylistic choices you've made. And that's not intended to be a criticism at all, but I think it would be wise, seeing that Fire and Blood toothless, I guess, that these be sourced, so that, you know, let us know where these arts and designs come from, and which ones are original designs. And I think that will make me feel better about buying any given product, saying, oh yeah, this is, you know, that, or yeah, this is from these guys under fair use, or whatever it is.
And like you were saying, Alex, like, I've seen a lot of people do house cards, other custom things, where they take the logo from the card and they just basically redraw it, and it looks 85% to 90% the same, right? Mm-hmm. I'm totally okay with that. It's actually because they're so the ones like the Lannister one that you were talking about, Alex, it's more of these newer ones that have a different brand, like the Targaryen, which is very different, the Stark, which is very different. Those are the ones that I'm more like, is that someone else's art?
Yeah,
exactly.
That's good. Well, I'm glad you guys got a chance to see the granite card, because it really is very impressive. I can't find any fault with the workmanship, and the feel of the entire thing is incredibly satisfying. So if you do have a favorite player that has a favorite faction, I'm sure it would make a wonderful stocking stuffer, and the stocking could then be used as a weapon, which would also be a plus. But I think
there's regionals coming up. These are great, you know, regional prizes.
Regional support prizes.
I think that's the coolest application, in my opinion, is getting a custom store-specific, tournament-specific prize, much like Red Saturday.
Yeah.
And I think it is worth noting that Michael Spaulding has definitely interacted with the community a lot in his efforts to make Game of Thrones products that people want. So through the Facebook group and other things, he's often asked, like, what would people think of that? And there's the running jokes as well, you know, people asking for a granite playmat or whatever, which, you know, I don't think you can produce in the kind of terms that would be necessary. But he's definitely been looking for projects and looking for to see how much support there'd be in the community for certain things he's keen on doing. So definitely he's worth checking out and just sending a message to if you're thinking of a project. I think This is me stepping out of the bounds of actually knowing things, but he's come in armor as the Blackfish to Minnesota tournaments, and I believe he has backgrounds in various crafts, not just this wood cutting and granite work, but I think he made his own armor and the like as well. So he's definitely someone who appreciates the hobby, but also has a lot of experience working with the kinds of materials that could make for absolutely great prize support.
Can somebody commission like a replication of ice with the store tournament and the name? And then can I win that prize? Because that would be amazing.
I used to give those out, ice. Alex has a hammer.
I have a hammer. But I don't think even Michael Spalding's best efforts could cause you to win a tournament, Sean.
Oh, ouch.
Closing comments. Normally we'd say all the things that are coming up in the next week or 2 weeks or three or now, but it's actually, if we talk about all the things that are happening between now and our next episode, we would be talking for a long time.
Because it's break time.
And coffee time. Coffee, wheezing time. Time. Normally we go on break until store championships start again, but they started 2 weeks ago.
Already.
So... Yeah.
So now we go on break until store championships are done.
Or until store championships start, I guess, next November. No, we really don't know when we'll be back. We've just in the last few weeks had quite a few things change. The recording software that we use has changed a little bit and isn't necessarily as compatible as it was with some of our guests and some of our hosts, cough, cough, who still use Vista.
That's Sean.
Not Sean. You don't get to pass the buck on this one, John. And then we also have some of the software that we use to assemble the podcast and do some of the post-production is tied to a computer that I know will not survive until we come back from our break. So we have to explore some alternatives to how we're going to approach those particular aspects.
Plus, we're tired. We're tired, Alex.
We always get tired around this time, but we do need a... We need a break from having to cast, and we need a break to recalibrate for a subsequent season. So as we know more, we will, of course, post on the Facebook group, but you won't be getting an episode from the next season in December or January at the very that those are completely impossible. And then after that, we'll see when we can get back to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And John, actually, we need a really snappy sign off for a season finale.
I'm so tired.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.